Oh, the shape up or get. If you've let all the fans down.
Can we not lock this?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, welcome along to Team 33. I am Raf Giallo. You can get in touch with us on Twitter at Team 33. We're also on Facebook and also on iTunes. The big interview this week is with Ian Wright, Arsenal legend. He was here for Cardbury Premier League event at the Aviva Stadium, so I popped out to chat to him. We have a full studio here, but before I get to all the lads, I got a good message from Jimmy, my old neighbour, who was manning the Esslin GA Twitter account. So I was asked to give a shout out to Esslin GA, and I certainly will. They are my town land. It's a great place, full of rolling hills.
Are they? Did they make the county final, Raf?
No, that was Mohill, which is the town that's nearest, nearest me. They lost all Willen, who are also known as the Willies. Whatever funds you want to make there, please do. But hello to Mohill GA as well. But anyway, back to the rest of Joe Coffey.
Ten in a row, Raf.
What?
Arsenal, 10 in a row.
Oh yeah, 10 wins in a row. We will get to
that. Well, we're talking about Ian Wright, like.
We are. We're going to play that in a short while, and we will get to Arsenal. Keane Roach, you're here as well.
How's it going, Raf?
And Niall McGrath, for the first time since the World Cup, returns to our studio. How are you?
Good there now. Yourself?
Good. And you obviously do Off the Brawl as well, which is a new offering on the Off the Ball network.
We've started now the last month, just before Conor McGregor's fight against Khabib Nurmagomedov. So, yeah, we're getting the MMA community excited, hopefully, about some content in the next few weeks. Some big interviews lined up anyway, so if anyone's a mixed martial arts fan, jump on board and get involved.
Definitely. Killian Woods, you're there from our Galway studio as well.
I am indeed, Raf. Good to be joining you. There is no crack in Galway. Zero crack.
And it's always crack in Galway, Killian.
And just outside the studio, we've Derek Ryan, who had his dinner in the microwave, is now eating that dinner, and we have a free microphone where he will jump back in once he has finished eating. It looks like a good dinner, although I can't actually see it. So anyway, look, Ian Wright was in town and he had something tastier, which was Cadbury sitting in boxes inside the Aviva Stadium.
Did you get any Cadburys out of it, Raf?
No, you see, I've had a fair bit of chocolate over the last
Cadburys are great at giving out hampers, you know.
They are. They brought a few in here as well, but I'm trying to keep away from chocolate.
Yeah, that's
the
great thing about Raf, like, he never needs a sweetener.
No,
like,
you don't even eat chocolate.
You do.
Yeah.
You didn't eat chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
That allergies and intolerances and all that stuff. They're all gone now.
Convenient.
It is very convenient. Anyway, look, let's just get the Ian Wright interview out of the way and then we will chat about other matters, including Arsenal, because, of course, Joe is here. All right, that was the Ian Wright interview. We're still waiting for Derek Ryan to finish his dinner. It's been a long 20-minute dinner.
Well, surprise, surprise, we don't actually listen back to the interview yet again.
Yeah, because, of course, all of this is live.
Yeah.
Of course, the Ian Wright thing that I kind of touched upon before we get to Arsenal, punditry as well, because we were talking about Match of the Day, Alan Shearer, and I know, Joe, you've made the point about Shearer improving over the years, and I kind of put that to Ian Wright, and he was like, he always had that personality. It's just only come out now.
Yeah, well, it takes quite a while for most players to settle into the role. I think some settle into it quicker than others, as you would have seen with Gary Neville. But for the likes of Shearer and Ian Wright, actually, because Ian Wright would have spoken a lot about, say, around 2002, 2003, that early part of the noughties, where he first did punditry. I remember he turned up at the World Cup in 2002. He was wearing some kind of karate outfit or something like that. Like, I remember him talking basically about he was put into a box by producers that he was meant to be the kind of crazy one and the one
court
jester. Yeah, the court jester, as he said himself. And he went, and it didn't work out for him initially, and he went away for a while, and he effectively decided that he was going to be reinvented himself, and he came back as a different person, a different personality, and it has really worked for him. I mean, he's made a hell of a career for himself now in football punditry, and He is a respected voice in the game and very respected about what he has to say about Arsenal.
Yeah. In terms of pundits now, you, Niall, obviously you were there filming the Gary Neville interview, and you did kind of half put a question to him, which he didn't expect because the cameraman isn't supposed to speak or whatever his line was. But outside of him, are there any pundits that kind of jump to mind for you and you kind of think, yes?
Well, interestingly, you mentioned Gary, you know, on how I think former players start off in the role. Gary's first appearance in Monday Night Football was absolutely horrific. He was incredibly nervous, and I think it's about even forgetting about, you know, your knowledge and your expertise coming in. It's actually adjusting in front of the microphone and the camera, I think, is the main issue. And that was clearly one with Gary. But in terms of analysts, I'd be more along the commentators' lines. I love, you know, who we lost a few weeks ago. Peter Brackley was one of my idols growing up. You know, the voice of Saturday mornings and football and things like that when you're coming up. But even some of the guys closer to home, I think we've some great guys here in this country who aren't afraid to speak their mind. And I think that's sometimes maybe in Ireland it's used for an effect in order to get a reaction, but I think there is some very sensible voices here. As you know, we've Keith here, obviously does a little bit of the football. I'm a big fan of Keith, but other sort of guys, I won't name exactly they are, I'm sure people can guess, you know, a lot of their stuff is put out for a reaction. Maybe it's not the most sensible stuff in the terms of along the terms of what we're actually consuming.
I wonder
and
who
watching
could be talking about
exactly. But you know,
but I think that side of football analysis is very important.
The entertainment,
yeah,
entertainment, baby.
Ah, yeah. I mean, certainly for Eamon Dunphy, whether, I mean, he'll always say that it was never for show. Obviously, people's opinions are completely different from what they see, but like, it really worked.
It does work, but when you're looking just for a reaction and it's totally infactual and there's nothing really to back it up, you know,
yeah.
He went along the lines, you know, obviously Cristiano Ronaldo for years said he was useless, he was rubbish for a long, long time.
Yeah.
He's a show.
I think it's important. I don't think there is a place for people that give insightful analysis, but there is also a place for people who are effectively there for the entertainment value.
Yeah, I can understand that, but sometimes when you see other good guys who aren't getting an opportunity, when you have the same voices for years and it's the same spiel, it becomes very bland for me, and you know, almost frustrating. And I think people maybe sort of copped onto that towards the end of the tenure of a certain crew that were in there, that they just wouldn't even tune in anymore. And a lot of my friends were like that anyway. I was certainly along those lines. I would have even turned over to a different network to watch, because he just knew what was going to be said, and it was just utter bullshit in my opinion, really, a lot of the talk. It was more entertainment than actual analysis of a game.
I suppose that effectively, because TV studios are so dominated by ratings, I mean, and
yeah, I can understand that.
But sport, by its nature, means that it doesn't really matter what the analysis is like, because you'll get high ratings for the match. It's a harder one to judge. But I suppose from an RT point of view, it would have been like, well, this doesn't seem to be broke, so why fix it?
I would contrast that maybe a little bit, because like a lot of the time, a lot of people will tune into like your Monday Night Football, and they'll tune into your Monday Night Football because they know the analysis, they're going to get all the weekend's games, everything like that. But I think there's a large population who will tune into your like match of the day kind of highlights, because they just want to see the goals, and they just kind of want like quick little snippets, do you know? Like, they don't want the game broken
totally
down
understand
into
it. Yeah.
Minute detail. I think Alan Shearer, as you said, he's grown into his position an awful lot. I think Ian Wright is the same way, but for a large extent, I kind of feel like people don't want it broken down into such minute details, especially for a lot of casual fans as well. Like, there's sometimes you'll be in work on a Saturday, or you'll have a long day, and you don't want one of them interactive screens pulled out, and you don't want circles put around everything. All you want is a quick little, like, he's there, he's going to knock, he wants those little, like, highlighted box in behind, he's going to knock the ball into space, he's going to run. And you have, like, maybe 90 seconds, 2 minutes of analysis, quick, and then we'll get on to the next game,
sorry to cut across for a second, but do you think is that the reason why football journalists aren't used in mainstream football coverage?
Well, possibly because of the amount of absolute garbage that is written in the newspapers as well, that never actually comes to fruition. You know,
but there are some really good journalists.
I know, 100%, there is someone, but on a large scale, you'll often see, you know, we had, I think BT Sport had it, you know, the European Football Show, they had a lot of high quality respected guys, but in terms of your everyday run of the mill football journalists, it's such obviously a saturated market because the sport's so broad and big. It amazes me sometimes how these guys who keep writing these rubbish stories still are actually employed and have jobs. So, yeah.
I think that's more to do with the recognisable factor, though, that people wouldn't really know who, like, you know, in terms of on TV, wouldn't really know who these journalists are.
You know who, like, the likes of Henry Winter.
People wouldn't know him to see.
I don't know, Derek. I think if you have anything, if you only have a very passing interest in football,
I'd agree with Derek there. I think there's a lot of journalists out there who don't know what they
have to appeal to more than just people who are, like, mad. And that's why, listen,
I think it's changing, though.
You were slagging Eamon Dunphy and rightly so, but at the same time, Eamon Dunphy was the entertainment factor.
In fairness, though, I think we do have to say Eamon Dunphy worked in the game for a long time.
But he was great entertainment insofar as if you want, you'd stick him on and you'd be entertained, you know what I mean? So he obviously thought that was part of his gig as well, which is, who's to say that wasn't part of his gig? At the end of the day, it's television and you have to entertain people. And there's a very small amount of people, not a very small, but there's a small amount of people maybe who might be interested in the tactical analysis of a game. There's a lot more people who might have a passing interest in the game and actually might watch Eamon Dunphy because he's saying something that's quite funny to watch.
That's true.
And you have to appeal to them as well as the people who are desperately in need of tactical analysis.
Killian, I know you want to come in on this, but just, I think a lot of the time, especially when you do get journalists on and you kind of, I think you run the risk of a lot of the time lads on Twitter, on social media, just being like, who's this fella? Like, he's never played a game of football in his life. Like, what does he know?
We got
may as well go home. Like, there's no point. That's just nonsense. And Robbie Savage like rolls that out. And it's just a nonsense argument to say that someone like, I would know many people now who would know more about football. I'm not saying I do. Who would know more about football than Robbie Savage? You don't have to be in a dressing room to know certain things that he talks crap sometimes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, we've gotten text messages into this show saying that, like, what if you guys are everyone to be there talking about football. It's like, it's not about that. We watch the bloody thing, so we just have no, it's natural to have an opinion on something you watch.
I think, you know, I think famously Michael Strahan said it a number of years ago as well, to an NFL reporter, and you know, I've had that crap as well said to me. Obviously I cover mixed martial arts to a large extent. You know, you've never been a fight, but like, listen, you're obviously allowed to have a constructive opinion as long as an absolutely off the charts
bonkers.
we're also thinking, like, Graham Souness, who is a respected footballer, won everything in front of him, still won't admit that Paul Pogba's a good player. Like, you know, true. We're not even talking about, you know, just journalists.
Yeah, like every industry.
Objectively wrong. Like, he's just wrong.
Like, you have an opinion. Like,
it's his opinion.
He's a very different midfielder to what Graham Souness was. And obviously Graham Souness sees his sort of midfielder as being the ultimate midfielder. And Paul Pogba was a very different midfielder to that.
The game has changed.
I agree. But, like, you know, he's... Yeah. But that's for, you know, in terms of talking about analysis, that's why Monday Night Football is so good, because it combines the analysis with a bit of crack. There's a bit of crack between Carragher and Gary Neville, and they're having a bit of banter there. And I quite enjoy that side of things as well as the analysis side of things. It combines everything, whereas you don't get that a lot of times. Sometimes analysis can be a bit boring if it goes on too far.
Yeah, and to a large extent, I think Sky have like boxed off a lot of those markets, because you've got your Soccer Saturday and you've got the lads in there having a bit of crack.
Segments, yeah.
You have your goals there. You've got your 5 or 6 o'clock news roundup. You have all your goals, you have all your highlights, you get a little bit of post-match reaction. If you're really into the weekend, or if you're really into the football, you'll probably have watched one, if not two, of the games on the Sunday, and then you'll tune into Monday Night Football, and then you'll watch the analysis as well. So there's something there. They cater for everyone, do you know that sort of way?
But it's very hard to do that as well.
But they recognise that not everyone wants that dense, broken down, like play by play of the game. Some people just want to, did you see what they said in studio earlier on, or did you see his reaction when a last minute winner went in?
To be honest, like, that's what was so successful about RTE's coverage, and that a lot of it used to evolve around what was said in the studio when a game, and let's be honest, a lot of Ireland games are fairly forgettable. Particularly anything that has happened since the majority of what has happened since 2002.
And who would want to watch a deep analysis of some of the games, you know what I mean? But you want to watch maybe
so then you do need people that can entertain. So,
but yeah, I think a large portion what RTE was, there was zero evolution over so many years that and even now to a certain extent, with a lot of pundits all over the world, especially in the UK and Ireland, they're guys who really haven't experienced what it's like to be a modern day footballer in terms of, you know, Gary Neville has experienced that, you know, Jamie Carragher has experienced that. They've the crossover between both sides. And I think that's why maybe people have gravitated towards Gary Neville, especially.
Yeah, because there is obviously, there's a massive difference between, say, even to be honest, like Graeme Souness is I'd be looking at Graeme Souness now kind of going, ah, Graeme, you're out of the game a long
time.
That's
why I think his opinion is on Pogba. Sorry to interrupt you. I think it's just because Pogba's very much your, and too much for me, the modern day footballer. You know, he's more interested about his looks than sometimes what he does in the pitch.
But I never, but pundits going at that about what kind of hairstyle Paul Pogba has, I can never understand that. That has absolutely zero impact on what type of
player
he is.
That's what they do. Yeah. But, you know, it's, I'm not defending either what they say, and I don't defend, like a lot of the things Paul Pogba does on social media, but at the end of the day, Graeme Souness, as you said, would have been, you know, take the two legs off a guy, sort of.
That's his idea of the
nonsense
player.
Exactly. It's very different nowadays, and I think it's very hard for them to understand that.
Nail in the head there, Niall. I think that's completely correct. Like, I think the, like Graeme says, I'm not saying there's no space for Graeme Souness in the game, and there shouldn't be ageism, shouldn't come into it, but I think it should be factored in that, and in his opinion, and a lot of stuff he says about Pogba, is that he just needs to factor in that he doesn't know what it's been like in the dressing room. When was the last time he was a manager? Well, 10 years ago?
Yeah. And he wasn't great as a manager either.
I think with Paul Pogba, like the pressure that he's under as a modern day player, I'm sure he goes away from training and he doesn't go home and sit and play PlayStation. I'm sure he goes to branding meetings because that's how much he is worth. He's a business. He's a walking business, Paul Pogba, and they're trying to, and there's people trying to advise him to maximize everything out of it. And that's getting his hair cut.
People active in the game in the 90s are even Shearer. Like, I know we're all saying Shearer's doing well now. But even you're getting to a stage now where, like, Shearer is a generation almost. I say Shearer is a generation before Neville. There was a bit of a crossover.
Like, I don't know. Sinéad managed like 10 years ago. It's only about 10 years that he's not in. He did manage at. It was in the Premier League. He didn't manage in League 3, like, you know what I mean? Mm. So he managed in the Premier League.
He managed badly in the
His tolerance for these players. I mean?
Yeah. But he had a good Newcastle.
He's a decent manager.
But like, it's just that the tradition and the money, and even the fact
the money
is massive, and the fact that players don't spend long at clubs anymore. I mean, the turnover of players is very rapid. Like, you're talking,
tactically, things have changed a massive amount. Yeah. You watch a Premier game from the 90s in terms of fitness, but in terms
massive,
of tactics,
massive difference.
It's kind of go for it. 4-4-2 go for it.
You look at I was watching the Premier League years there one night. It was one of the years Arsenal won the league, and you'd be watching some of the goals Arsenal get. And like, I mean, they're lovely goals, but like, the amount of times a player would find himself in behind the defence with literally no defender around him, and all he'd have to do is round the keeper, and you'd be going, Christ almighty, it's just so different now. And this would be going on at Highbury, where the pitch is tiny.
Yeah, it'd be a very common goal back in the day. Yeah. You know? It just shows you how even, you know...
It doesn't happen. I don't know. Maybe you don't see that happening as much anymore, where a player is
raining the keeper. You don't. And you did get it a lot back in those days. You'd have your Anelkas, you know, guys played off the shoulder, getting around the back and slotting around the keeper. Because, as you said, you know, the whole nutrition, fitness, everything, pitches even, were even if you look back, some of them,
the pitches.
And we thought those pitches were good.
And actually, it might tie into one of the other things I was talking to Wright about, which is the classic front twos. Now, he was involved in those kind of 4-4-2s, and then you had, like, York and Cole and everything else.
For one season,
they were the best front two ever. But like, I kind of miss that front two thing. We don't talk about it now because
not
everyone
really
plays like front three.
Yeah,
because
even
striker,
like, I mean,
or
people,
no striker.
Like, even like, traditionally, you would be talking about, say, and I'm going to bring it back again, Lacazette and Obama Yang. I've been practicing.
Almost a year of him at the club, and you still can't say.
I think I have it now.
No, you don't.
Obama Yang. Obama Yang.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Anyway, but like, if you wound back the clock, they'd probably be operating in as a front two for Arsenal rather than having him one kind of out on the left, say, or. You know, it's just very. You do miss that, but the game goes in circles. I mean, I think 4-4-2
will come back. Definitely, yeah. It'll just be a different different variation.
Hybrid. Like.
I remember World Cup 2002 when Duff and Keane were playing together as a front two, and you're kind of looking at that going, how, you know, because we're so used to seeing Quinn and Keane together. For me, like, in terms of 90s,
let's play front two.
In terms of 90s front twos, that was the perfect front two. There was, like, a big tall lad, knocked it down, and a small lad who's a decent finisher and popped the ball.
True, it was very successful.
Obviously,
very
successful. And it was successful in World Cup 2002. Obviously, the Germany game. But you could, the you Duff could, thing you could. Like, I couldn't understand how Duff and Keane was going to work.
But you could argue that if Quinn and Keane were playing front two for Jesus, I can't believe we're talking about this. But anyway, if Quinn and Keane were the front two for Ireland, now that tactic would be still very effective.
Oh yeah,
but I think it was a very common trait back in those days. It was just you know, you had your big guy and your smaller guy. He was being nippy around him, link up the play.
Yeah. Phillips and Quinn.
Yeah, they scored.
It was only Raul and Morientes. Yeah, like, you know, all these were combinations.
One of Ireland's most famous goals is Ireland against Germany World Cup.
Yeah, let's say it's
from
a
that
quint,
exact
yeah.
thing. Knocked the ball up to Quinn, heads it down to Keane.
Well,
and
Mark Hinslow was in this very studio, said he didn't just knock it up. It was a good lofted pass.
Yeah, because also Mark Hinslow flies the pass. I remember that. Yeah,
there was one novelty. I just want to come in here while we're talking about strike partnerships. Now, I am absolutely open to correction on this, 100%. But I just found it was such a novelty when you consider, like, how multicultural the Premier League is. Now, as far as I remember, somewhere I read that Benny McCarthy and Jason Roberts, when they played up front for Blackburn together, I think they had a good little spell up front. They both learned Spanish so they could talk to each other in Spanish and the defenders wouldn't be able to understand them. Now, I am open for a crutch, but I have this, like, seared into my brain somewhere, and I'm almost sure it's right. But when you think of, like, the multicultural mosaic melting pot, whatever you want to call it, of the Premier League and how many multinational players playing there, it's so strange to think that, oh yeah, we'll just learn Spanish and, like, we'll have an edge over, like, the whole defensive line of the whole. Like, you wouldn't get that now.
No,
you wouldn't. Like, completely different. Yeah. But that one always stuck out for me because I was an admirer of Benny McCarthy myself. But just when I saw the two of those, and you're like, oh, yeah, like, good strike partnership, whatever. But, like, they really bonded, went out of their way, said, look, we're going to be a standout partnership because we're going to go and do that something a little bit extra. We won't do it on the training pitch, but we'll, like, work out signals, we'll work out something in a different language, and we'll be able to get around the fence that way, which I thought, like, that's brilliant. That's putting the extra effort in. That's like York and Cole stuff. That's
Andy's sort of advantage. Yeah, absolutely, definitely. And Benny was a bloody good player as well in his day.
For me, Bergkamp and Henry were, in terms of Premier League front twos, they just complement each other so well. For me.
There you go, Derek.
But, like, Bergkamp was pretty much a 10, a modern day 10, and I just loved how
Bergkamp's still the best footballer I've seen in the Premier League.
Bergkamp could play with anyone, though. And it was a beautiful, you know, they complement each other very well, but anything sort of Bergkamp did, he could bring players into the game, he could sit up top, he could play any sort of role up around there, and just a fantastic player. I remember some of the most standout moments for me with Bergkamp were probably the Dutch team, you know, Dallas in 1994. That was just one of the best goals I think you'll ever see.
The 98 one, Frank de Boer spent the ball, and then whatever the Dutch commentator says in Dutch.
Just incredible goals. But, you know, there's so many different variations. I think you're big and tall guy, you have York and Cole, a little bit more pace, you know Juventus in 1998, the away leg in Turin, the goals in Barcelona, you know, the little 1-2s, intricate details. They could both, you know, sort of rotate. And I think Andy Cole was probably something he didn't get a lot of credit for, but his holder play was very good as well, and he could bring players into the game with his back and, you know, put balls around the channel as much as Yorkie did. So there's so many different, I think, combinations. But Raf, what's your stick-out combination?
I would almost go maybe Bergkamp-Henry as well. Maybe not even the United one. I was quite young when York and Cole were going. Like, I've seen all the goals and stuff, but I don't really remember it as much.
Do you know what the great irony about this discussion?
What?
We're talking about players that were active 20 years ago.
And we're giving out
about pundits been stuck in the past.
But yeah, I think in terms of, you know, partnerships, it's tough even in the last 5-6 years to get one.
Because it changes. Teams change. So teams do change so quickly.
You could probably say Ronaldo Rooney at one point, maybe in the last 10 years.
Yeah, but then you throw in Tevez as well. Obviously, part of that front three.
Yeah.
and Berbatov came in the year after. So, I mean, again, it's not really a front.
There was Drogba and Elka 1 year at Chelsea. I think it was 09, 10.
Shearer, Sutton, Rooney Van Persie. The SAS.
Rooney Van Persie was
Rooney Van
decent
Persie
for that 1 year.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I suppose, I suppose when you're looking at City, you go, well, Silva's been there a long time and Aguero. I mean, they're not a 1-2, but, like, you know, you're talking about a creative player and a striker, and they've been kind of.
Sheringham and Cole, who hated each other, but.
Yeah. Teddy and Ollie as well, you know. Yeah. Solskjaer. You know, Teddy was one of those sort of Bergkamp-esque players, and you could put him sort of on in with anyone, obviously better playing a little bit deeper. And there was just so many brilliant variations. I guarantee we're forgetting a few now. I tried to look up some earlier on.
But ideally, my front two is either a Quinn Keane, big lad, small lad, or else Bergkamp, you know, pretty much a 10 playing.
Like a Peter Crouch, Jermaine Defoe, Portsmouth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did we mention this? Sorry, I've been Googling furiously to like vindicate what I've just said. It's actually, I found it's
Roque Santa Cruz, isn't it?
It is Roque Santa Cruz. The Mirror in 2008, David Anderson wrote, Benny McCarthy has revealed how he and strike partner Roque Santa Cruz have been driving defenders loco by speaking Spanish.
But it wasn't Roque Santa Cruz from Paraguay.
Okay. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like I just always had that in my head. I was like, imagine going
Suarez and
like,
Sturridge, lads. We forgot about that one.
Suarez and Sturridge.
Oh, of course,
short lived. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that was.
It was a more, sort of a more modern one. You know, there is Shearer Sutton, I think we mentioned a few.
Oh, Shearer Sutton, lads. Come on. In terms of Premier League, for two, Shearer and Sutton.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
SAS.
Unbelievable. Shearer, yeah. Sheringham for England.
Yeah, Sheeran Sutton, that was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
It was quite special.
Yes, it was a special.
Bergkamp and Wright was a good partnership for.
I think
2 years.
The season, basically, 97-98, Wright got injured towards the end, and that's how Anelka got into the team. But the year before that, Wright was very effective, and he broke the record. That 97-98 season, I think 97, in September 97.
It was a game against Sheffield Wednesday, was it?
No, Bolton. He actually, he went a few games without scoring, and then I think he broke the record against Bolton. Hmm. But
We're forgetting a European one.
What?
Rebrov and Shevchenko.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When Rebrov was actually good.
Dynamo Kiev.
Shevchenko was good.
Yeah,
they were two. Now, actually, Killian, just to bring you back in, I think you want to talk about VAR and what's happening in Australia. So, what is the situation?
It's a mess, Raf, is what it is. Like I predicted it would be, it's a mess.
Killian, like, you're jumping the gun on this, but go on anyway.
I am. No, I'm not jumping the gun, because essentially the A-League, which is, I wouldn't necessarily have the utmost respect for it, it's kind of in the MLS. You watch some of the... You watch some of the kind of highlights every so often. I watch the highlights of the MLS as well sometimes. This is a bit of a tangent.
Where do you get the highlights, Killian?
They're on YouTube. So like, I just follow these channels. And you just catch the odd one, especially the MLS. You watch that and you say, God, you think the MLS is getting its act together. And you see some of the goals that go in. You're like, ah, lads,
just before you get to that, actually, the one where Rooney chases back. And we've seen Rooney is no longer the player he was. And he chases back, wins the ball at the halfway line.
Scores,
back.
Yeah.
That wouldn't happen in the Premier League.
No, they'd be gone a mile down the pitch if something like that happened.
But still,
he was doubled over like after to celebrate.
He hasn't done that in about 10 years.
Yeah, Killian, go on.
The A-League is a similar mess, it looks like, at the moment, but it's compounded by the fact that they're a test bed, or they've agreed to be a test bed for kind of the first canary to go down the mine, as I saw some person write for the
VAR.
Nicely
caught, actually.
It was some clever Guardian writer. I was like, oh, that's a nice turn of phrase. I might steal that, but then I admitted it's his, so I'm not going to plagiarize him on the radio. So at the weekend, there was a really controversial decision. They went to the VAR system essentially to decide a penalty. The referee made the final decision himself, didn't refer it on. He decided to go to VAR, watched it. It wasn't a penalty. He deemed it was a penalty. It wasn't a penalty. Now, my problem isn't that the VAR is falling apart. It's not that the technology isn't up there and the camera angles aren't good enough. It's the fact that we're getting into, we've discussed this before, and I think this is what the real kind of talking point is. So people think VAR is going to fix the bad decisions, when it's just caught, there's no way of really fixing the bad decisions. I think this guy, the referee, went to the side of the pitch, caught every single angle you could want, every single angle we watched, and every angle we watched fans have watched since, and still came to the decision that it was a penalty. And it was blatantly, I don't think it was a penalty. It was minimal contact. And it's also borderline, possibly not in the box. But he decided it was. And it's just that we're getting to the stage where VAR, and even my uproar about it is that it was heralded as this thing that's going to fix football and hell. And I've seen in the World Cup there was some use to it. But the mess it's causing in... Not necessarily slowing down games. I'm beyond that kind of, I suppose. It's been shown the World Cup not necessarily slow down games as much as I thought it would. But we're kind of getting into this phase where we just expect it to fix football, and it's not. It's clear, and the A-League is showing that. And actually, it's interesting that at the end of last season in the final of the A-League, VAR was, I hadn't heard of this until yesterday when I read the piece, that it was had a huge issue with VAR where the camera angles that TV had weren't available to VAR, and therefore an offside goal was allowed. And the VAR was down for a few minutes during the final. So we're kind of getting to the stage where I know the technology for when it's working is up to scratch, but, you know, then you're getting to the stage where players are saying, maybe we need to redo this game. We're just robbed in a 1-0 bit loss in this A-League final because the VAR was down for a few minutes and the play had already gone on, so the offside couldn't be given. And it was from an indirect free kick that went in. All the players who were attacking were offside. Ball goes in, and it's something that should have been judged offside wasn't given. And so I just see there's so many flaws now coming out of VAR. And for all the benefits it can bring, I think it's not worth rolling out wider. I think we've gotten on, and actually at the weekend as well, what I thought was really low blow when I end my rant now, this is the last bit. The Australian League came out and sided against the referee and said the referee was wrong, which I think is a terrible precedent to set. I admit that over the years, I've heard Graham Pohl say before, the referee from the Premier League, that they would always back the referees in the Premier League, no matter what, and they would nearly to a fault. I think that's a terrible precedent to set where we're kind of going against referees and making it harder for them to do their job, where post-match we're just going to, their authority is going to come out against them and say, you made a completely wrong call. And I think we need to back the refs in this and go away from VAR. I don't think it's working.
But do you not think, Killian, it's far too early to be judging VAR?
Well, I think there's been a whole year there in the...
But I'd be arguing what you'd need to do is you'd need to look at VAR in 5 years' time and see if it's working.
I feel like, but this whole kind of idea of re-refereeing games, like I don't see what, like, is it really going to improve the game that much?
Like, well, I mean,
I'm not talking about ghost goals. I'm not talking about a football where the ball goes into the net and pops out the side. I'm not talking about the blatantly over the line stuff. I'm talking about we've gotten by so far in football by just watching it happen and fold in front of your eyes. And clearly there's so much that's objective or subjective, I've mixed them up, but there's so much that can be just decided in the heat of the moment. Different people have different opinions, no matter how many times you watch it. And it drums up talking points for radio shows like this.
Yeah, but in the World Cup, it brought drama to games where there would have been absolutely no drama without it. I mean, and that would be my point. I mean, football is entertainment now, and they're trying to compete. We've talked about it enough on this show, where you're trying to compete with all the various forms of Netflix and YouTube and Twitter and everything that people can be looking at on their phones. And anything that adds a bit of drama that isn't completely changing the game is surely a good thing.
I don't know. It feels like there's, and maybe I'm blind and I'm kind of stubborn and wanting this to fail, but, which could also be a huge factor.
Well, you do hate it.
I'm not a fan of you. I hear what you're saying there. And my argument before was essentially that I feel that one of my main arguments against VAR, not to complete parrot the same thing again and keep going over and over again about it, is that if it's available to the top level of the game, it's kind of we're at a stage where the lower levels are being left behind, and money is now turning the top level sport into a different sport that is in the third league or even the championship. Like, how wide can we roll out VAR where the game is now just, and like, you know, name a small club, Northampton Town play Man United in the third round of the FA Cup, is VAR in that? But if they played Yeovil, it wasn't, you know. I think we're getting to a stage where if the technology cannot be rolled out across the whole game, like that's where you're kind of borderline getting into fragmenting the sport at the very, very top level.
Yeah, like I know I agree with that, and that's a point probably that I haven't really thought about as much. Like, personally, with VAR, I've never seen it as kind of a fix-all. This is gonna this is like your shining knight coming over the hill. This is the thing that's going to fix football. But I think at the very highest level, there's so much at stake. There's so much money. And I think there's so much pressure on the referee that you have to give them every opportunity to get the decision right. And I think if VAR is available, if it's just another facility that's there that allows the ref to get a... Because, like, if you're in Old Trafford or you're wherever, like, you have 70,000 people screaming down from the stands. You've got 12 players... Or, sorry, you've got 22 players on the pitch, each one of them shouting at you for, like, whatever different point of view they've had. You've got two managers on the touchline. Like, for the most part, I think you really need to give the referee the best possible decision or the best possible chance to make the correct decision. And I think that's kind of what it's based in. I do understand that if you're going to have, if it's good enough for one team or if it's good enough for one league, it has to be good enough for the rest. And I do think you make a solid point about it kind of fragments it. But like, I think you would be kidding yourself if you said that, like, football is already fragmented anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, the Premier League, the introduction of VAR.
I think with VAR, it's the refereeing of it. It's the problem. It's not used in the correct manner, in my opinion. I think what they should have done originally when they put this in is do maybe like a tennis-like system where it's actually the teams who have, you know, three calls. If you contest one right, you get it back. You lose one, and then if you're out of your whatever your three goes, then tough shit, you're gone. Like, you don't have another.
Yeah, and there's stuff to be ironed out.
It could morph into that because if you look at even some of the decisions in the World Cup, I remember Mitrovic had a penalty, and that goal, if they'd have got that penalty and scored it, they would have been through to the next round. Things like that, you know. And you look at the lower down league teams, if it is implemented in League One, Championship, whatever, you know, some of these games, playoff, Championship final, 50 million, it's very important to have it.
Yeah, but it has to start somewhere. Sorry,
but the infrastructure needs to be there. No, and the ruling.
My point is, it has to start somewhere.
Product.
Okay, roll it out in the Premier League, roll it out in the Champions League, roll it out in the World Cup. If it works in that, then you can start rolling it out everywhere else. So in 10 years' time, it will be in all these.
But I think it's been thrown out without any real thought behind the actual structure of.
I do think the World Cup, there, a lot of people didn't really know what was going on, including maybe the referees didn't really know exactly how this is going to work.
But should be the referees with the ones actually, you know, policing it. Should it be that system where you have, you know, a team, you know, it's probably getting monitors and stuff like that.
It is a bit more complicated than the rugby system where you have a person up in a studio making the decision for you.
Yeah.
The fact that they're still leaving it down to the referee who is looking at a TV screen for about 60 seconds and is out of breath.
And has to say, yes, I was very wrong there. Well, it's very hard to say maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, you see, this is probably going back to what you're getting at, Killian. A big issue with it is it's still been left down to the referee, which brings in the whole thing of, will the referee be happy to turn around and change his mind?
Decision.
Whereas in rugby, that decision is taken out of the referee's hands. And he's told whether he's right or wrong.
I tell you, Rich, I think the whole structure is flawed and the way, you know, should it be left to the referee? Should it be, you know, the coaches who make the decision? Should the coaches have some upstairs? You know, at the top level of football, this can easily be implemented.
Of course, yeah.
And it should be if it's there. And it's typical FIFA, UEFA messing around. And they should have put something in place that was more thought through, in my opinion.
I do think professional, any club that's professional should have the finances or certainly be able to get the finances to put a system in place. I'm sure FIFA, with their billions of whatever currency, would be able to afford grants to smaller clubs and everything like.
I think you're like, Niall, your point is that like it should be pretty much perfect by the time it's rolled out. I mean,
not perfect. They should have a better structure than they had in place coming into it. Because
my point
is,
you'll only get that structure by ironing out the issues along the way. So in, like I say, in 3-4 years' time, you'll be going, well, this idea didn't work, but we're going to take ideas from that to bring into this one.
They came out with very smart in the first place? Not in my opinion.
Well, in terms of making the ref go over and maybe change his
it's very
decision,
naive.
No.
I agree. It certainly adds to the drama.
In 5 years' time, you would hope that it'll be a lot further down the line in terms of.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, but again, I think it's like a lot in the hierarchy of football and football clubs that, you know, often things aren't thought through very well, and it's frustrating. Really, it is, because, you know, obviously the money's there, the technology's there at the highest level to do it. So, like, why shouldn't it be ironed out and be in place properly?
Mm. A final place to end, and this is more frivolous than VAR, but the Bohemians jersey, if you did see it, the away jersey. Now, this is the away one. Now, it, as Richie McCormack on the news round on Off the Ball pointed out,
it looks like a musician's t-shirt.
Yeah, before we get to your point, which was already revealed on in the WhatsApp group,
it really I think it appeals to the.
It's not actually Bob Marley, by the way, as well. It's like because of like copyright issues and that. It's like a likeness of him.
What? Okay.
Oh, stop it! Really, is it?
I thought it was you.
Oh, an image of Ralph.
It's all right. What's the connection?
I think it definitely appeals to the football hipster.
It does,
and,
yeah.
And it strikes me it was designed with the football hipster in mind.
Okay, yeah. Right, but in fairness, if you took away the likeness of Bob Marley or whatever, but
the whole point is it's Bob Marley.
No, yeah, I know, but if you took that away and you just had the Carlo-esque stripe going down the front of it, it's actually a nice jersey.
Ah, yeah.
It is. It's actually...
Well, as I said, it looks like a t-shirt you'd buy in a musician shop or something that's kind of cool and you'd wear it like... it's one of these... In fairness, it's definitely one of these jerseys that appeals to the whole, this is a piece of fashion, so I'll wear it everywhere.
But
that's good marketing. Like how many of those are you going to do? The fact we're talking about
is another thing. I mean, they're fair play to them. They were bold. Why not? I mean, what's the point designing another jersey that looks like every other jersey we've ever seen?
Bose have a track record in the last few years of trying to do things differently. They had the club boat who we had on this show.
To be honest,
it's horrific.
I don't like the jersey, I'll be honest. I sometimes think some clubs try too hard to be hipster, and maybe Bohemians could be guilty of that. But in fairness, I mean, fair play. Like I say, we wouldn't be talking about a random jersey.
And O'Neill's.
So fair play to them for O'Neill's throwing this out there. They're marketing themselves.
I will say, it is fascinating how different O'Neill's design a soccer jersey in comparison to how they do a GAA jersey.
Didn't they do the DR Congo one?
They did for the 2016 or 2017. Yeah. I remember looking at that, which it was a smashing looking jersey.
Mr. Green, these are obviously, I don't know who Mr. Green are. They're obviously.
They've been sponsoring them for a while.
Are they a clothing company?
I think they're a betting company.
Yeah. Okay.
But is this the last year of Dailyman Park? I'm pretty sure it is. You would think they would have maybe had something like that.
I think it's a fascinating jersey. I think it really appeals to football hipsters.
Why is the face on it? The
face is surely part of this sponsor then.
No, it's not because I think didn't Marley play Dailyman Park many years ago?
It is Bob Marley.
Yeah. What?
It was his last European tour date or something like that.
1986.
It's an interesting person to like. So this is the last season of Dailyman Park, so they obviously wanted to pick something to mark the fact that this is the last.
I presume their whole thing is that commemorating Dailyman Park.
Okay. Arsenal wore red current jerseys.
I think it's a jersey that a lot of Bohemians fans would buy. Do you get me? A lot of people who are maybe fans of Bob Marley would buy that jersey.
It's in papers all around the world, by the way.
I saw it in papers.
Oh, there you go.
In France.
That's all they want.
I saw a tweet about papers in France.
It is interesting just how different, though, it is, like, you know, from the GA style and the fact that they manufacture both. It's interesting to look at the fashion that prevails in what may, like, because, you know, the fabric is probably the same, but it's interesting to look at like the difference that prevails in the two sports.
Yeah, and what's expected
now. Round necks are in every sport. Keenan's just showing us the DR Congo. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, kind of cool.
It's kind of nice, isn't it? There's a bit more to it than say the gap.
Raffer, we're going to talk about Arsenal now, like.
Yeah, okay, go on.
Can I just get a final cut in on the ball?
I think was trying to make a point before we continued on. Something about the face, I think.
Yeah, no, I was at Joe addressed that. It was like what the face was about. It's an interesting approach. O'Neill's did this the other year. I know they did well. I remember looking at the sales for that commemorative 1916 jersey. That was them, right?
Oh, yeah, it was. And they've rebranded. Like, O'Neill's have been like looking at their stuff. I mean, gradually they're becoming like, say, even the fact that like if you look at. And this actually is something that isn't noticed that much, but what they do now for All-Ireland Finals is they print both counties' crests on the football, and they have to say, you know, it's gone very much down the same road that soccer has gone down, where, you know, you have unique match balls for the event, and obviously O'Neill's have rebranded as well. They've got, had a rebranding exercise, so the, you'll see in the, even in the way that's written, that look, that looks a little bit different too. So I think that they're doing very well.
Can I just say that we've been going on for you for a long time, and everyone about League of Ireland clubs not knowing how to market themselves properly, and this
that's,
is them
that's exactly
marketing
good,
themselves
yeah.
brilliantly
yeah.
and fair play to them. Like I say, they've been talked about all around the world, so it's not something that I would buy. But at the same time, fair play to them. There's newspapers in France and everywhere else in the world talking about this jersey, so fair play to them.
And that's something how you can differentiate yourself. I mean, the jerseys are a big deal. Like, people are, yeah. like, I mean, I remember in News Talk for before the 2014 World Cup, I mean, was it on the sports site, as it was at the time, it was like, you know, these are the World Cup jerseys coming up at, in Brazil, and it got a colossal amount of hits. And like,
I'm sure the Nigerian one sold out for the.
No, this is for the 2014 World Cup. I haven't looked at any hits for 2018. Should they? Yeah, but the Nigerian one sold out for the 2018 World Cup.
It was different. I didn't like it now.
But, you know, like, it's these things are a big deal. And
there
this
are fans,
is,
like I say, all over the world who want that jersey. That,
yeah, exactly. And that's
and
what it's all about.
Who might hear about Bohemians Football Club that wouldn't have heard about them before.
Yeah, yeah. And as you said, it's a bit of a fashion statement as well. Like, people like that look of. Like, we've seen. There was a model wearing a 2002 Republic of Ireland World Cup jersey. Do you know what I mean? So it is a bit of a fashion statement.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like,
Aircom.
There you go. That's a beautiful jersey now. I'd say really like that one, Aircom 2002.
Actually, there was a, and I think we tweeted out at the time, there was a Japanese.
Yeah, that's the one.
Was that the one you were talking about? Yeah. Sorry. And yeah, the model was still wearing that. He was wearing some weird trousers, but the actual Ireland jersey. And it was just bizarre, like, that whatever, 16 years on, they're still talking about, well, they still have some
memory. They're still talking about Saipan, like, exactly. Yeah. 16 years.
Korea, Japan,
yeah.
Nothing but was Roy Keane right?
I was literally talking to one of my colleagues about that exact conversation today, about Saipan and who was right or wrong. Oh, 16 geez. Years later, we are still talking
Christ
about
that. It's done, right. It's over.
Never.
Are we done?
Arsenal for Sam Raff.
Yeah, they're going well.
10 out of 10.
They haven't defended very well, but
they're winning games though. This is their longest winning streak since October 2007.
Liverpool to come in 2 weeks.
Yeah, that'll be the acid test now.
Considering you had your first two games and lost City, Chelsea,
and Liverpool,
which is fair enough.
Liverpool are winning but not playing that well. So it's going to be a great
test.
That's
the worrying thing.
Yeah, well, that's true. In fairness, it's been a weird season though, in that, like, Tottenham have had an amazing start to the season.
Without actually playing well.
Harry Kane is out of form. Liverpool have had an amazing start to the season, and
had a great start, and then they've kind of veered off the last.
Yeah,
four
but they're
or
still
five games,
still winning.
Still winning games.
Man City are obviously blowing most people out of the water. But, like, I mean, if teams could keep this up, you've got 2 points separating the top five. After have we played 8 matches now?
And United are still.
In touch.
I know. Yeah, I know. It's
like
tenth.
The weekend was a good result.
I think they're 10 points off the leaders, something like that. But, like, I think Liverpool won away to Huddersfield this weekend.
1-0, yeah.
Tottenham won away to West Ham.
Yeah.
And these are like just 1-0 wins.
Yeah.
And, like, arguably, Huddersfield were well in that match against Liverpool. I'm pretty sure they smacked
the post.
Yeah. But it's just one of those things that they're just going to win. They'll win 1-0. They'll just grind it out.
I think there's a lot more substance amongst the top four or five this season.
Yeah.
A lot more resolve.
Yeah.
About
you'd be hopeful that there is going to be a genuine title race this year. Mm.
I still fancy City to maybe run riot second half of the season.
Be great if you could get to March and there's still to be a contest, but not just a contest between two. A contest.
I think they will. I think there could be three or four in the run this season.
Yeah.
Generally do. I think Manchester United will make a late surge.
I have to say, I've been pleasantly surprised at Arsenal.
Yeah, the third goal against Leicester was just
incredible. Like, they're playing decent football now, and, you know, I mean, it's early days, but
I still think, though, push comes to shove, you go away, you know, mid-January to Burnley, you know, turf moor, horrible place. Yeah. It's cold, it's wet, it's dark, it's rainy.
I see how Stoke has been replaced by Burnley.
I think Arsenal are going to have problems still. I just don't think they have spine in their team and that hard element that really want to know about. And it's been a problem for years and years and years. I think Emery will address that, but I don't know if it's going to be this season.
Well, I think that, I mean, Arsenal would certainly have a much better, I think Arsenal have a much better chance of finishing the Champions League now at this stage than United have.
Oh, yeah.
And I think
I don't know.
I still think that Mourinho would probably need to be sacked for United to get to finish top four this season.
Like I mean, and like
I
if you like,
United, I just see United did well at the weekend, almost got a win against Chelsea. Obviously beat Newcastle. At the moment we're watching it and United are 1-0 down to Juventus with 20 minutes left in this game. It just kind of feels like it'll be two steps forward, one step back with United with Jose in charge.
Well, I think Juventus is a very different proposition to a lot of Premier League clubs, in fairness. But,
no, but like...
True, but yeah. I mean...
Like, lost to Brighton a few weeks
I think the point has always been with Mourinho. The Newcastle game, people were talking it was a good win and all that. And then there's all this talk about turning a corner, but they never turned the corner. I mean,
they were 1 minute away from turning the corner. Come on.
Against Chelsea.
If they beat Chelsea.
My point is, I'm not sure they're turning the corner. I'm not sure
huge.
If they're just some good results.
Yeah,
and
that's
more
what I'm talking
about.
But good results always. Like, I think if you get one or two good results like that, especially the nature of the Newcastle win, if they come from behind again to win and they go and they beat Chelsea 2-1, like,
but there are huge issues in that United team insofar as obviously defensively is the biggest issue.
And that typified it. The draw against Chelsea typified that, like, even in the last minute, you couldn't just like throw everyone back and just shirt up like the way Jose Mourinho would. But if they had gotten two wins like that back to back,
the referee gets
you'd
six
be
minutes
100% back them to be like, right, they're going to win another one. They're going
to
win another one.
I'm starting to like them.
With the quality in that team, like, would you have been surprised if they went two games like that and then they went and won another three or four in the past?
I wouldn't at all.
The point is, after Newcastle and after Chelsea, you still don't know which United is going to turn up. Okay, you're right about Juventus, but I don't know who they're playing at the weekend, but if it's Burnley at the weekend, which United will show up? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The point is, you need another 6-7 games to see, okay, maybe they have turned the corner, but I'm not too sure.
Well, I think just as a final point for me anyway on that, like, I do think they've turned the corner insofar as the performances, when they look like they want to play and they look like they're playing for the manager, and they do look like they're playing for the manager
right now,
they have looked a different proposition to like the start of the season. Just
this narrative just sounds very much like Arsenal under Wenger, when they want to play and when they feel like turning up, and you know they'll go out and beat one team one week, but then they'll get hammered against Watford.
Well, I think it was 10 years
week.
With Arsenal. It's only a half a season
with
United.
Slow decline.
For United, I mean, like,
and
fair
I think
enough.
The whole witch hunt was there before the whole summer. We can go into that if we want.
But like what you're talking about with United is you're not just talking about Mourinho. You're talking about a success. Like, I mean, fair enough, winning cup competitions, but you're talking about a succession of failure year after year since Ferguson retired. That's what you're talking about. Like, I mean, we're not just talking about Mourinho, we're talking about season upon season of things going wrong on a fairly consistent basis.
Yeah, well, we will probably talk about Man United again because we tend to talk about them a lot, like this season at least. But I think that is it for this week's show. So Ian Wright was the main interview, and thanks for Keenan Roach for coming in.
Thank you very much,
Joe Raph. Coffey.
Raph, pleasure as always.
Derek Ryan.
Thank you, Raph.
Niall McGrath.
Pleasure, my friend.
Good stuff. And Killian Woods.
At last. Thanks, Raph.
No bother. We'll be back next week, as always, on a Tuesday. I don't know what's going to be on the show, but we'll think of something in between. Take it away, Johan.